Sam, keeping it true, watching old movies so you don't have to. With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see where the movies truly awful, or did it change history? Good evening, and welcome back to Season 2 of the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, the movie podcast in which a father and son talk about movies that they watched together long ago. We give each movie a score from memory and then re-watch the movie to see whether or not the movie is better or worse than we remember. With me, as ever, is my son, Sam. Good evening, Sam.
Good evening, Dad. How are you doing?
I'm really good. How about you? How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. It's good to be back.
It is good to be back with Season 2 of the Benefit of Hindsight podcast. Can't believe we got to Season 2. I was reading on the internet and it said that only 4% of people who start podcasts get past Episode 6. So well done us for being in that 4%.
Well, and we're here to announce that this is the last episode.
So thanks for listening. It's not the last episode. It's the first episode of Season 2 and we're terribly, terribly, terribly excited to be back. As we've had a bit of a gap, I'm absolutely certain that there must be something truly exciting that's happened to you that you're dying to share with our listeners. So over to you, Sam, for what I can only assume will be the best anecdote of all time ever. Anything you want to share with the listeners, Sam?
So you'll never believe this, but the craziest thing happened to me since we've had a break from the podcast.
Okay, so Sam, something has happened. Share with us your anecdote.
So, right, I left the house this morning, okay?
Yeah.
And when I got to the end of the street, I had to wait for traffic to pass.
Wow. Okay.
Right? It's not incredible.
It's amazing. Moving on. So, for our first episode, I'm sorry, I'm still stuck by your anecdotes. Before we move on, because have the movie rights been sold yet?
Yes, but I can't say by who. It's under strict contract.
That's a shame. Well, listen, if you're out there and you're interested in the movie rights to Sam's anecdote, I don't think it's too late. You can get in touch with us at thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com.
We're taking bids.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the bids are going to start pretty high, so you want to get in there pretty quickly.
Already quite high, actually. Anyway.
Yeah, so thebenefitofhindsightpodcast@gmail.com if you want to bid on Sam's anecdote. The movie rights are currently under negotiation, but a good bid will win them for you. And so you'll know, if you're a regular listener, that the first thing we do is go to our listener questions. Now, we did a Q&A episode to round off Season 1, but nonetheless, we have had some questions since we did that, and quite a lot of emails from people saying they really enjoyed listening to that. And as I'm sure you've seen, we've had a good 5 or 6 emails from people who asked the questions just saying thank you for featuring them. So thank you very much for that. But this is a question that's come through from Maggie, and Maggie is in Los Angeles. And let me go through a bit of this email here. It says, "Dear Dean and Sam, thanks very much for recording these podcasts. They take me on a little trip down memory lane from movies that I watched when I was presumably at the same age as your son, Sam." So that's quite nice. And she also goes on to say that she was one of the few people that she felt in America that understood the Wallace and Gromit Curse of the Were-Rabbit movie, and says hashtag Team Marrow all the way. So thanks, Maggie.
Brilliant. Perfect.
We like you already. Her question is this, however. She said in the Q&A episode, we were asked the question about the movie that you would want to be stuck on a desert island with. Okay?
Yeah.
She has asked us this question. If, she says, when you opened the case and you were to find the wrong disc in the case, what would be the worst movie you could find yourself with on a desert island?
Oh, there's probably a lot of good ones. In terms of movies that we've seen together, which I think I wouldn't want to just watch on a desert island or like have to watch over and over again, Boy in the Striped Pyjamas.
Yeah,
that wouldn't be good at all.
Yeah, that's a good one, because good movie though it is, it's not really one you want to rewatch. I don't know if you remember this. I don't know if I have a memory of you and I watching a movie together called The Road. Maybe we didn't watch it together because it might have been quite grim. It has Viggo Mortensen in it. Does that ring any bells?
I've definitely heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
Okay, so I thought we may have seen it together, but it would be surprising because it's a bit grim. But I watched the movie, I thought it was brilliant, and vowed never to watch it again because it's just heartbreaking at the end. So right. my answer is to that good question is The Road with Viggo Mortensen in it. And yours was The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas.
Yeah, it's a good question.
This is a really good question. Do you know when I've read the question, my first thought went to the SpongeBob SquarePants movie.
No, I think I could get on with that pretty well.
Yeah, and then I thought, well, you know, maybe I could, if there was nothing else to watch, I could probably watch that.
There was an anniversary for that recently, and they did a screening of it, and when it hit the Goofy Goober rock song, everyone was singing along in the cinema.
I saw a thing on the internet the other day, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but apparently Keanu Reeves had turned down a couple of really big roles in Hollywood movies, having taken what he described as a bit of a break or whatever. But he did agree to be in a SpongeBob SquarePants movie, which I thought was really cool.
He did, yeah. It's not the one that we saw, but he has been in it, yeah.
Good old Keanu Reeves. We love him, don't we? He's a decent guy.
He's a legend.
He's an absolute legend. Talking of legends, we should move on to the movie that we went away and watched during our mid-season break. And the movie that we watched was the 2004 Sam Raimi classic Spider-Man 2. And I have a strong feeling this is one of your favourite films.
Your strong feeling would be correct.
So I'm going to just hand over to you, I think, for quite a lot of this. But I'm gonna just ask this question before we go on. You gave the movie a 10. I don't want to know whether or not you've changed your score. Is there anything in this movie that would have made, on this rewatch, that would have made it more your favourite or less your favourite, and why?
I don't know about just this rewatch specifically, but there is one thing that kind of bugs me about the film. No pun intended. Technically, he's an arachnid. I don't think there's anything that particularly ruins it or makes it better every time I do watch it. I think it's just one of those timeless films where I can always enjoy it and never really see anything wrong with it apart from one specific thing. But for me, I like it every time I watch it.
I don't know if we were getting onto this too early. What's the one specific thing?
It might be too early. I don't know. There's this scene, you know, when Peter goes to meet Doc Ock for the first time, and it's all this Nobel Prize, that bit. Peter and Octavius are in mid-conversation, talking about the machine and things like that, and then it cuts to a new scene, and they're sat around a table, and he says, "What have we been talking about for the last hour and a half?" It's like, okay, you've clearly just jumped to a scene and said, "We're an hour and a half later," or whatever it is. And it just feels so jarring, because they could have just made it quite natural, but it just jumps out to me as, oh, you've just thrown that in because you needed to show a passage of time. That's the only issue I actually take with this film.
I'm gonna lead off with quite a big question here. And my big question is this. So obviously I do my research. The Wikipedia entry says that the movie is widely regarded as one of the best superhero movies of all time. Okay?
Yeah.
And do you think that's true? I know that's a big question to get into straight away, but
yeah. So I would say there's three of the biggest superhero movies of all time, or not necessarily biggest, but the greatest, best maybe if you want to give it that. And this is definitely one of them. I think if you're talking about live action films, I would say there's only two of them.
Okay.
And that would be The Dark Knight, where Christian Bale Batman, Spider-Man 2, and the animated one I would give to Into the Spider-Verse. But I might be getting my wires crossed in terms of best Spider-Man film. So I definitely think it's up there, and I can understand completely why people would say this is the one of the greatest of all time, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely.
Would you disagree?
No, I don't think I disagree with it being one of the greatest superhero movies of all time. I think it is. I also read a thing that basically said that it is, it's described as one of the best sequels of all time, and that it kind of is the blueprint for all subsequent sequels.
I'll agree with that.
And not just in the Spider-Man universe, like all sequels post 2004 are following the blueprint of Spider-Man 2. And I think that's probably fair enough. I had sort of one old man issue with that. Can I tell you what it is? Can I tell you what it is? I'm going to get into this straight away.
Go for it.
So it's not far away from being a very similar plot to Superman 2.
Right, yeah.
So in Superman 2, you have the hero who's torn between his heroics, his life as the superhero, but he's also in love with Lois Lane, and he wants to have that relationship with Lois Lane. He wants to be a normal person. So he goes off and he does a thing in his ice palace, whatever, and he loses his powers. When he comes back, he's then able to have this relationship and to be happy, but realize there's a gaping hole in his life. Meanwhile, there's a group of villains who are terrorizing Metropolis, and so he has to get his powers back to then go and save the city, but in so doing, gets the girl at the end.
I think you've ruined Spider-Man 2.
So I think it follows a classic sequel formula, and it's not even that dissimilar to Rocky 2, the great boxer who decides that he wants to get back in there, but he doesn't have the conviction and the courage to do it because he's had a family and he's not motivated, and he requires somebody to tell him, no, this is who you are, this is what you do, get out there and do it. And off he goes, and he beats Apollo Creed by 1 second.
Spoilers.
And the Rocky franchise is set up forever. So I agree that it's a fabulous movie and a brilliant sequel, but I don't think it sets a blueprint for sequels. I think it follows it, and I wanted to get that in soon. And I think it's maybe a bit of a rant too soon, but I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, admittedly, I'd never heard of that before, but it is a very interesting point that it's... I feel like those other two films have been overlooked in the sense that Spider-Man 2 is just... I don't want to say it's a bigger hit, but it's more well-known, I would say. Like, it's more timeless than the other two. I've probably just angered a whole fan base by saying that.
I don't think you have. I think it's all about where you're from. I mean, I remember Spider-Man 2, which would be, sort of maybe 83, 84. So therefore, I'm kind of similar age as you are to watching...
Superman 2.
Superman 2, sorry, yeah. Which is, I think it might be a bit earlier than that, but it's certainly kind of late 70s, early 80s. And I just thought it was really interesting that actually what it's doing, it's using classic sequel tropes, and that's why it's such a good movie. Ta-da.
Yeah.
All of that said, it is a really good movie. I want you to tell me your top three favorite things about this movie. You have to choose them now, because I know it's probably in your top three movies of all time ever. So from the top three movies of all time, choosing the one, tell me top three things in this movie for you.
Okay, firstly, train scene.
Okay,
that's
yeah.
It. I think, do you know what it is? It's going to sound really vague, but I think overall the second thing might just be the story, because I really like the story.
Yeah.
And I really like the way it's done. And I think the third thing, is this going to be stupid and obvious too, is just the fact that it's a superhero movie that's timeless and enjoyable no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And just a really good movie. What I like about it is there are things that happen in the movie that are allowed to you to take a breath, take a pause, to pull yourself together a little bit, because you know you have to have these peaks and troughs of action, and then they don't repeat. They're just really nice character things. One of my favourite scenes on a rewatch, and I think I'd probably forgotten it from watching it before, was the scene with the chocolate cake and the glass of milk.
Yeah, so I had a point about that as well later on, but
It doesn't do anything, in my view, in that movie to further the plot. It doesn't do anything. It's not driving the plot forward. It's just a really, really nice, quite nicely acted character moment. And I just thought, and I really like the fact that they could do that in the movie. They could take these little pauses and give you stuff that was just really just character, and I think that's one of the reasons why this movie is so highly regarded, because it's not just, in fact it's surprisingly low on action. It's you know, there's a whole hour in the middle in which it's just story.
And yeah, absolutely. As well, just on the back of that, there's even that scene where he's on his way to MJ's play, and then he gets the robbers happen, and then he gets rejected, and then he drags his broken bike back, and it's such a character moment, and you see the aftermath of all of that action and all of that reaction to it too. Mm-hmm. And I think it humanizes the film rather than just this person's got inhuman abilities. That's what they're doing. It's just he's also a guy.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, and I think that's always been the strength of Spider-Man anyway.
I was just about to say that.
I think that is the strength of Spider-Man. I think that's why Spider-Man is the best superhero, because whoever you are, you can identify with that character.
Yeah.
See, I've always had a problem with Batman for completely the opposite reason, which is I don't think Batman is an aspirational thing, because he's not really even a superhero. He's just an incredibly wealthy man. And that's great, and if you like Batman, whatever, and things, but there's no superhero in there, and he's not an identifiable character. Maybe that's why he's successful, though. Maybe that's a different, certainly
yeah,
different,
I suppose, yeah,
certainly a different question, a different podcast. The other thing I like about this movie as well is it has a really good villain.
Yes, yeah, that's another thing. Sorry, was that? Do you want me to talk there? Because I just kept on saying yes.
I just knocked that one up in the air for you to whack.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I think Doc Ock's such an interesting character, and this is very much an interesting take on the character too. Because I feel like in a lot of other media, he's this big genius who always has an evil plan. But like a specifically evil plan. Whereas in this one, he's kind of just... He comes across more as a mad scientist who wants to succeed, and mm-hmm. he doesn't really care who gets hurt or what happens, as long as, I mean, I think supposedly it's the arms that are in control, telling them what to do, but there's got to be some sort of subconscious element to it where he wants to prove himself right, and that's how he's going to do it, as opposed to another version of the character going, yeah, I want to kill Spider-Man. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Yeah, he's an absolutely classic villain, in as much as the villain... The best villains are always motivated by the desire to do something good, but it always ends up being bad. There's always a kind of thing in there, which is so you know, like Thanos, it's not necessarily a bad thing that he wants to sign up, free up the universe and you know, make it so it's clean and inhabitable again. It is a bad thing. In order to do that, he has to kill 50% of the people that are in it, or the things that live in it. So there's the motivation isn't bad necessarily. They're behaving bad, but motivated by a good thing, because Doc Ock just wants clean renewable energy, which is a good thing. But it kind of there was one kind of little thing where I thought, okay, you want clean renewable energy, great, that's really good, and you need this kind of unheard of, presumably made up element in order to do that. I wasn't really clear what I needed the four arms for.
No, I think it's sort of like they're my helpers. They're here to help. But at the same time, it's like, well, do they need to be? I suppose lifting heavy objects and getting close to the sun.
Yeah,
you're still quite close to the sun.
Yeah, and you could have got kind of, you know, four robots who might have been able to do something similar. But, you know, or even four people in heat suits. Even better, four Peter Parkers, because as it turns out, they are, Spider-Man or not, absolutely impervious to flames.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I mean, the firemen are running into the building with hoses and helmets and flammable or inflammable clothes, and he just runs in a pair of jeans.
Yeah. Have you noticed that in that scene, though, the little girl that he saves is wearing knee pads?
Yeah. I've also noticed that she changes size quite dramatically.
Yeah.
So he picks up what appears to be a six-year-old, and hands over a baby, and it's like, oh, how did that happen? There you go. That's a minor quibble.
I don't think I've ever realised that.
So he doesn't hand over a child. He hands up a blanket. There's obviously something child shaped, but not a real child inside of it. And then you look down, and there's this kind of cute little face staring back up at you, and you think that's not the same thing that he picked up. It's 50% smaller, anyway.
I've never noticed.
It's kind of a minor thing. We would always normally talk about cast, but there's not that much cast changes, except for Alfred Molina as Doc Ock, who I think is magnificent.
I've made a few notes about new cast just in case, but I do think out of any of all the people you could have cast to play Doc Ock in that specific role, I think he was perfect for it because he's able to just switch from being Alfred to being Doc Ock, and I think it just worked so beautifully well.
Yeah, I agree. He's really good. And again, the other when you do a movie villain, it's always a good idea to hire a really classically trained English actor. That's what you need. So and it works really, really well. I have to say, I'm going to say it again. I said it in the original Spider-Man movie that when we did the podcast. I love J.K. Simmons.
I was wanting to know what your opinion was this time around,
I love him. I love the character. I love the way he plays it. I went out on a limb and said it might be the best performance by any actor ever captured on film, and that's a bit of a stretch. But honestly, every time he comes on screen, it's just an absolute joy. He's so good at that.
It's another one of those things about the film where it just breaks from the action and gives you a bit of comedy and character, and it just
Absolutely.
works.
I like it when his secretary keeps coming in trying to give him a message and he keeps sending it back out. And eventually she gets the message out, which is, your wife's called, she's lost a checkbook. And his reply is simply, good. And then he moves on to something else. I thought it was
Thanks for the
great.
good news,
Thanks for the good news. That's it. That's the line. Really, really, really good. And I recognize that actress, actually. I couldn't place her, but
It's Elizabeth Banks.
That's it. That's who it is. Yeah, wow.
Everyone forgets that she's in the Spider-Man trilogy.
Yeah, no, I had forgotten she was in the Spider-Man trilogy. But the two leads are really good in this, aren't they?
I think I can't remember if I mentioned this the last time, but the character of MJ is so badly written that it kind of bothers me sometimes. She just cheats on everyone in every film.
Yeah, maybe that's true. That's true. She doesn't come over as the most that's very true. Yeah, it doesn't come over as the most loyal thing unless well but
No.
she's loyal to Peter though, isn't she? So
When she wants to be, yeah.
and she's always been sort of constantly rejected by the person that she loves, or at least, thinks she loves. But it is a mean thing to leave that poor guy standing at the altar.
Yeah, that was my other thing as well about him in the film. I thought his performance was a bit wooden. I don't know if he's supposed to come across that way, but it feels that way to me sometimes.
It's not a very well-drawn character, is it?
No.
All you really know about him is he's the son of J. Jonah Jameson. He may or may not be an astronaut. Certainly he's something in the Air Force. And he's enormously wealthy, despite the fact that his dad is just a humble, lowly newspaper editor. And I think it's probably just, it's like a two-dimensional character drawn up to be the exact opposite of Peter Parker. Square-jawed, handsome, all-American guy who is utterly reliable and terribly dull.
Yeah, I think that's probably just what it is, yeah.
So, but yeah, I never really thought about that. I never really thought about the MJ thing before. She's only loyal to Peter when it suits her.
Yeah, I think that's probably a really good way to put it, to be honest, without just immediately hating on her, yeah.
I don't think you have to hate on her. I do think there are some kind of gaps in the story, which is, her face is on a big billboard at the beginning. She appears to be a, somewhat successful actress working on Broadway or just off Broadway, and it would be interesting to know how she got there, and why she got there when there are so many aspiring young Broadway actresses in New York.
True.
She doesn't seem to be a very good actress because she spends most of her time on stage looking into the audience, pausing between each line to see whether or not the person that she's hoping to be there. So there's not much focus.
She needs
Other
prompts
than
as well, yeah.
yeah, needed a prompt, and at the end of it, needing a prompt, everybody went, "Oh, you were amazing." Well, she needed a prompt though. She wasn't invested in what she was doing. It wouldn't last 5 minutes in the real world. We can't hate on MJ. It's not fair.
No, it's not fair. They're destined to be together.
I also thought James Franco was pretty decent in a fairly thankless role. He has to smile, brood a little bit, get angrier and angrier whilst holding a glass of whiskey, and then ultimately be convinced by his dead father to get his revenge. It just felt like that again was another character where, there was some development, but not as marked as Peter Parker's development. Do you have a view on that?
I do, yeah. I think his character and his arc, so to speak, is very much the payoff is in the third film. I mean, We've got our own thoughts and opinions about that. But I think you have to have the slow build up to what that is going to be. Otherwise, it seems a bit too sudden and doesn't quite work. So I kind of like it in a way, because it's very much, you can see where he's heading and you can sort of understand what he's doing. It's not that involved, but as soon as he figures out the secret, okay, now we're going.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's fair enough. But the interesting thing, actually, I'm sort of going to contradict myself here, because the interesting thing is he probably would have forgiven Peter had it not been for the intervention of his alter ego in his dad.
That's a good point, actually, yeah. I also really like how the follow-up to that scene where he's at MJ's failed wedding, he's wearing a green bow tie.
Yeah, lovely little touch that, isn't it? Yeah. Little sort of knowing look, little glint in his eyes, and he's wearing a green tie, so he has already made his decision at that point, right?
It's like in the first film around the dinner table where Peter and Norman are wearing the opposite colours to the alter egos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to just make a point about Aunt May as well, and I think she's really good. I think the actress playing Aunt May is really good. Again, possibly a slightly thankless role. She just has to be sad all of the time. But she plays that classic sequel role of being the person that tells the character who's not quite sure about what their destiny is at this point to get out there and be the person that they want to be. So, and that's classic kind of sequel trope. And she does that so well. She's such a good actress. And I just wanted to just heap some praise on Aunt May, who I just thought was really understated and really good in the movie.
I think I can say, I can may or may not be able to confirm or deny that scene where she says the big speech may or may not bring a tear to my eye every time.
It may or may not, but yeah, rumours of that.
May or may not.
rumours of that cannot be confirmed nor denied. I just think she's great. I do take the point of the latest Spider-Man movies, when we get into the kind of more recent ones, that Peter's not an old man, and that maybe other iterations of Aunt May and Uncle Ben are a little bit old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I do like the... I do like the kind of more recent Spider-Man. Is it Marissa Tomei, I think her name is? I think she's a good aunt.
Yeah.
So I think she's a good Aunt May as well. It's probably about the right age. But, you know, in the comics, Aunt May is sort of classic grey-haired old lady. So, and I just thought she was really good in that. And one of those roles where, you know, it could easily get overlooked in this size of movie, but just does it really well.
Absolutely.
Let's do the questions. Let's do the classic. We're on the benefit of hindsight questions. So it had a budget of $200 million, which is a decent amount of money in 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And any guess to how much it made?
I think it probably made maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah, it did. It made $795 million.
Oh,
so
wow!
It was very successful. The first trailer of the movie was played during screenings of The Lord of the Rings Return of the King.
Wow.
So I suspect we sat and watched the trailer for this movie and got all excited and did the old thumbs up thing.
Probably. I wish I could remember that moment or go back to it anyway, yeah.
It's unfortunate, but yeah. It then went on to be very successful as a DVD. In the United States alone, it sold 11.6 million DVDs and grossed $174 million just on DVD alone.
Wow.
And it was the first of Sony's Universal Media Disc formats to be released as well. One of those things that really didn't catch on. A little later, it came out as a Blu-ray. With an extended cut.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up, actually.
Spider-Man 2.1, which I don't know if I've ever seen. Oh, and that went on to be Sony's highest-selling Blu-ray for a very long time. There you go.
Wow. I was going to ask, actually, if you've seen 2.1.
No, I was trying to decide whether or not I should watch 2.1.
Yeah, me too.
But then I decided, no. It's in the same way that we decided not to watch the extended editions of Lord of the Rings, because that's not what we saw at the cinema. I thought, no, but I would like to go away and watch it.
I think it It doesn't add a lot, but it does add quite a few interesting character-driven scenes as well. And I think if I'm going to just sit down and watch it, I think it's my go-to version to watch it. But for the podcast, I watched just two, yeah.
And do you know how many Academy Awards it was nominated for and won?
All of them.
It did, yeah. It won everything. Yeah, it's the it won more Academy Awards than any other movie in the history of... No.
I've just realised the answer's actually on my screen. I've never noticed that before.
Is it? So go on then.
It won one Oscars, had 25 wins and 60 nominations, apparently.
It did win a lot of awards. It won Best Visual Effects. It was also nominated for Sound Mixing and Best Editing. It received 5 awards at the Saturn Awards, including Best Film, Best Director. It won many, many awards and was considered, you know, it's a supremely important movie. The visual effects were done by a guy called John Dykstra, Dykstra, John Dykstra. And he was the guy that did the special effects for Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, cool.
Back in 1979. So there you go. You're right. I mean, we could list all the awards. It won an awful lot. It was nominated for BAFTAs. The thing that I like about this movie is actually a good film.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's a superhero movie is not an afterthought. But it's just part of the whole fabric of the movie. It's just a really, really good film.
I also think it's directed very well too. Like, Sam Raimi just always knows what to do.
Yeah.
It's always well shot.
I noticed in this movie in particular, there's a lot of Sam Raimi tropes in it. So not so much in the first movie. I always get this impression sometimes when and maybe this is just completely made up because it is definitely speculation. But when you hire a well-known director to do a really big movie, but it's the first one in a franchise, they're kind of just holding back a little bit. Okay, there's going to be lots of notes from the studio. They kind of know what they're looking for. The movie then goes on to be a massive hit. And on this time, on this occasion, they kind of go, Sam, you know what you're doing. Sam Raimi, you got this. You go away and you do the same thing again. And so the director has that little bit more creative freedom to put his own stamp on the movie. And there's a lot of little kind of Sam Raimi tropes in there, screams to cameras and, you know, kind of things that you might see in sort of some of the Evil Dead or Living Dead movies that you made. Yeah. I just thought that was a really nice touch as well. And it really felt like it was a Sam Raimi movie rather than a movie directed by Sam Raimi with significant notes from the studio.
One thing that I always appreciate about Sam Raimi as well is his horror background. So that whole scene where Doc Ock, just sort of the birth of Doc Ock, where it's a really horrific scene. It fits so well within the film because he knows how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely right about that. He kind of brings a bit of horror to it. Yeah, in just enough way for it to be a bit, ooh. But in a movie essentially for children, teenagers and their parents, ta-da, us, it's just enough to be a bit scary, but not a film you can't take your 7-year-old to.
Yeah, not going to have nightmares, but you understand the point, yeah.
You must have on this movie, which I know you have seen, I believe, 167 times, you must have quite a number of out-of-pocket takes.
Oh, I don't know about out of pocket. I've got one important one.
Let's hear it.
Which is that in this universe specifically, Peter Parker should have ended up with Ursula because she's just better for him. And I'll stand by it.
Chocolate cake girl, Ursula.
That's the one, yeah. Although it's debatable whether it is actually chocolate cake because it's very much not a chocolate cake, just cake with chocolate on it.
That's very true. That's a detail that I picked up on as well. I think you might be right about that, though. She clearly loves him, and there's this in that again going back to that scene. There is this tension between them.
Yeah,
it's almost like that's the life he could have.
Yeah, yeah.
He could have this life, and he walks away from it. And I think you might be right. He should end up with Ursula.
I also think she just sort of likes him for who he is. Like, it doesn't matter that he's living there or that he's got loads of problems or stuff going on. She likes him for who he is as a person, rather than MJ not knowing who she wants.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, maybe, yeah. Did she appear in the third installment of this universe's Spider-Man?
She is, yeah. I think she brings some cookies instead, though.
Okay, well, that's I haven't seen Spider-Man 3 for a long time. That's a different podcast, but I'm glad she comes back because I just think that the character's utterly charming and lovely. And maybe you're right. So are we saying that your out-of-pocket take then is that Peter Parker and Ursula should have just become a thing and not MJ?
It is, yeah. And I'll die on this hill.
I'm going to die with you on that hill. I completely agree. I just think she's lovely. I just think, you know, there's a life there that he could have had. Maybe slightly less exciting life, but who knows?
I don't know. We'll never know, yeah.
Yeah. You must have fascinatingly interesting trivia as well.
I hope so.
Let's hear it.
This one I didn't know. I thought it was quite interesting. Apparently Willem Dafoe wasn't originally supposed to be in the film, but he was walking back to his apartment one night and saw the cast and crew filming, and they said, "Do you want a cameo?" So that's how he ended up in it.
Well, and I'd heard something similar to that. I'd heard that he'd something about kind of knowing it was happening, either because he'd seen it, but he then got in touch with the studio and pitched a way for him to reappear. And they went, "Oh, yeah, that's a good idea." And they sort of hastily rewrote that scene in. It's the same anecdote, I think.
There's like a weird internet joke, though, where for Star Wars, I think one of the examples is Hayden Christensen saying, "Oh, I just decided to fight some children," and George had the camera running, so it's in the film. But like, that's what this feels like. It doesn't feel like it's a true bit of trivia. It just feels like somebody said Willem Dafoe walked past one day and he was in front of the camera. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is an interesting thing that it's great to have him in it because he is good in it, in his little cameo. He's really good in it. But it's sort of, you don't need that. You don't need Harry to decide he's going to get revenge on Peter without that. I think it's just kind of, it's good to get him back in there. You could stick him on the posters. That's a thing. It's a nice bridge for us to see why Harry changes his mind about forgiving Peter and he's going to take him on and become Green Goblin 2.0. But if he took him out, Harry would still have the motivation to go on and do what he did because he still killed his dad, right?
He would, but I think I disagree. I think it needs Norman Osborn to be there, to be that figure. It is a cameo. I'm not denying that it's a cameo, but I think it's more of an actual role in the film that is needed to me. And if you told me that it was the plan the whole time, I would have absolutely believed it because it just made sense to me in that scene. I think it sells it more.
Okay, I wouldn't disagree with that, actually. I mean, you know, we're not here to argue with each other. I think it makes sense. I guess it's that, it's a thing. I guess if you're the script writer and you're looking for a hook to kind of convince the audience that, you know, Harry's motivation is clear and that, and you can see where the next movie's going to go, it absolutely works for that reason.
I'm not trying to say you're wrong or anything.
No, but I can see why you would put it in.
Yeah.
I'm just not convinced that it requires that. But if it didn't have that, then I guess Harry's motivation for revenge is less clear. So from a story point of view, it definitely works. And he is good. I do love that bit where he kind of finds that kind of secret passageway into this, you know, world of his father that he really didn't know anything about. I think it's quite a nice bit. Any more trivia?
I've still got a few, yeah. So another bit of trivia, Alfred Molina, and I did know this one, who's obviously Doc Ock, named the four mechanical tentacles that he had just as an actor, not as a part of the film. So they had Larry, Harry, Flo and Mo.
Brilliant. Classic. I wonder which was which.
Well, it says that Flo was the top right tentacle because it was operated by a female. And apparently that particular tentacle was the most motherly because it removed his glasses and gave him a sip of his drink.
Okay.
I like that.
Okay. That's nice. We'll come back to your trivia, but we haven't mentioned the CGI, and that's a good time to do it because I'm guessing a lot of the tentacles are CGI. It's aged pretty well, but I don't think it's quite as good as some of the kind of later iterations of Spider-Man in terms of kind of the flying through the city stuff. Do you agree with that, or am I being overly harsh?
Well, I think I agree. I think Spider-Man 3 kind of doesn't do CGI quite as well as Spider-Man 2, but the later ones definitely do improve from Spider-Man 3. It's funny that you mentioned the tentacles, though, because they were actually more or less most of the time they were actual physical props.
Wow. Okay.
I got that sentence out eventually.
You did, yeah. Well done. Excellent.
I think when he comes back in No Way Home, though, they're definitely CGI there.
Right. Fascinating. Yeah, because by the time you get to No Way Home, then CGI has moved on hugely and probably cheaper than building the kind of, you know, the machines and hiring the people to control. It's probably, that we just do that in post. It's fine. Look at these tennis balls on a stick.
Yeah, to the point where Tom Holland's running around in a grey suit and they can just CGI it later. That is a bit unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is absolutely true, yeah.
This is another bit of trivia that there's quite a few bits in one piece of trivia here. And it's another shout out to Rosemary Harris. When she's taken hostage and helps Spider-Man, she performed the action scenes herself. Apparently she enjoyed doing them, but Alfred Molina didn't enjoy doing them because he said he's not very good at them and he doesn't want to take the work away from the stuntmen. And on top of that, the stunt team would actually trick him into performing stunts.
I quite like that from Alfred Molina, because you get a lot of actors that do their own stunts, and I never really thought of that, and that's always seen as a really good thing, but I never really thought that maybe they're just taking work away from somebody else. Yeah, Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Back to Lord of the Rings. That doesn't make any sense. Apparently this film, Spider-Man 2, took the record for highest one-day opening on a Wednesday from Return of the King.
How dare it?
Yeah, oops. Shouldn't have mentioned that one.
how very dare it? It's very interesting, that is, actually, because I suspect it probably deserves it. I don't know that I think it's a better movie than Return of the King, but it's definitely a movie that you can see a lot of people going to go and watch, and it got really good reviews and notices and things. So yeah, that's fair enough. And all things must pass, right? So nice. Well done, Spider-Man 2.
And my last bit of trivia I thought was just a bit of a funny one to add. The violinist, who's in the movie a few times, you know the one.
Yeah.
Apparently she had an extra scene, which I don't even think is in 2.1. When Harry hears her from the balcony of his father's townhouse, he pours a glass of scotch on her. I'd love to see that.
That's cool. I'd forgotten about that, but I do like those little notices back to the original Spider-Man television series, because you know that's the theme music that she's singing from the Spider-Man TV series from the 70s, and I grew up with that, and so I like that. It's really good. It's a really nice detail in the movie for people like, I think the movie is perfectly designed for people like you and I when we went to watch it.
Absolutely.
Because there's enough drama in it to keep you kind of grumpy parent who's been dragged to see Spider-Man 2 interested, and there's enough action in it to keep you interested.
Yeah.
Although I'm not insulting you, I know you probably got all the story stuff as well, but you know what I mean, right? It's a really good.
I don't think I would have, but
it's a really good blend. So you know, it works really well for that. There are movies that don't work well for that.
Yeah.
There are movies that are just designed for children, or movies that are just designed for adults, and this one is multi-generational. I wanted to just mention the soundtrack by Danny Elfman.
Yeah, I think it's good. I like it a lot. I think the thing I like about it is that it plays off from the first one quite well and builds upon that, especially sort of the bigger superhero theme and then also the villain theme. But I don't know if it's one of the greatest. It's not one that I would immediately switch on, other than something like in this trilogy, Spider-Man 3, or later on the other films. I think it's definitely got some big moments that I do like, but it's got so few of those that I've rarely listened to it, apart from the soundtrack with all the actual songs, not the songs in the film, but like the credit songs and things like that. Those are classics to me.
It's I said Danny Elfman it is a good soundtrack. That Spider-Man theme, I think it's if in the list of iconic movie scores, sort of rousing bits of music that signify a thing that you immediately recognize with, I don't think it's up there with Indiana Jones, Star Wars, Jaws, or frankly anything that John Williams did. But it's definitely up there in that, it's definitely in there, you know, it's definitely sort of top 10. If you hear that music, you know it's Spider-Man, and it's great, and you kind of get that. What's interesting is that they had a massive falling out, Danny Elfman and Sam Raimi.
Is that what happened?
They had a massive falling out during the making of this movie, and Elfman said that composing it was a miserable experience. And so he walked away from the project. Two other people came in and did other scores, a guy called Christopher Young and somebody called John LaDuca, and John Debney came in and did scores. But ultimately, he sort of came back to the project before the end of it, brushed up a little bit of what they had done and so on, and then took the credit for writing the score, or was rather given the credit, because otherwise, if they took the credit, that sounds a bit unfair. Right. But yeah, the score has a really interesting kind of cycle that, you know, that he just described as an absolutely miserable experience. Doing it. So I just think stuff like that's really interesting, because you want to imagine that these things are joyous experiences for all involved, and it just doesn't seem quite right that it was a miserable experience for somebody, and doesn't really say why, but there you go. It doesn't have any bearing on how I feel about the movie, but it's one of those things where you just want to think that everybody likes each other, they're all having a brilliant time, they're all in it for together, and it's just not, you know, just yeah, they had a falling out. What a shame. Is there anything else then you want to say about Spider-Man 2 before we move on to our inevitable rewatch scores?
I'm going to say two things.
Let's hear them.
One of them, I really hope I'm not going to butcher a definition here. When I watched it this time around, I noticed something that I thought was incredible that I've never noticed before. And it's one of those things where you might not notice it unless you know it's there.
Okay.
The credits. No, that's a joke. It's back to the scene where Harry he's found out Spider-Man's identity. It's his best friend. He's contemplating it. And then all of a sudden, you can hear the Green Goblin laugh. And it becomes this big moment of what's going on. There's a specific technique used by whoever did it, Sam Raimi probably, which is called the Dutch angle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that is?
I don't know what the Dutch angle is.
That sounds patronizing. There's probably a better definition, but to put it as like as simple as I can do it without getting it completely wrong, it's when the camera tilts slightly to the side, so it makes you feel uncomfortable, and it just fits in so perfectly with that scene, because as soon as the laugh happens, it tilts, and it's like, oh, okay, something's going on, and you kind of unknowingly acknowledge it, because mm-hmm. you know, because the angle's changed. That's the whole point of it, I think, is like, now that it's on this angle, you feel uneasy. And it just works so well. And this was the first time that I really noticed it.
Wow.
And it worked.
Okay.
So if you watch it again,
I will watch
it
again.
Or at least that scene, watch that bit because it makes you feel it.
I'm definitely going to watch 2.1 because I'm interested in it. And because I haven't seen it. I'm going to watch Spider-Man 2.1. So I will be looking out for the Dutch angle in 2.1.
There's one particular scene I really want you to see in 2.1, which involves J. Jonah Jameson. But okay. That's all I'll say if you're going
to
watch it.
Right, looking forward to that. Okay, I'll let you know what I think about that.
Cool. My other point, my final point, is that Mr. Dikovic is the real hero.
Okay.
What a great character. He's got some great lines. That's all I'll say.
He is a great character. He's also named for the much less well-known second creator of Spider-Man, along with Stan Lee.
Steve Ditko, yeah.
That's
I knew that one.
Yeah, so yeah, I thought that was that. I love little details like that. It's just layers upon a canvas, isn't it? It's just, you know, little things to discover.
They do that a lot in the newer ones, actually. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
With some of the newer writers as well.
I did want to ask you a question, which you may or may not want to answer at this point, and you may not even be able to give an answer. But Spider-Man, in all his variety of iterations, has appeared in so many movies. Okay, you've got this trilogy, you've got The Amazing Spider-Man, you've got Tom Holland in all the Marvel movies and his own series of movies. And outside of that, you've got the two really good animated Spider-Man movies. And I just wonder, do you think this is the best Spider-Man movie, or is there one that we're going to watch or that we're not going to watch because it doesn't fit into the theme or the premise of the podcast? Is there a better one, or is this the best one?
This is the best live action Spider-Man film.
Okay.
So that's my answer.
Okay, so we won't get. I'm sure we might get onto the. There'll be a way that we can get onto the two animated ones, I'm sure, later on. But okay, my next question is, again, you might not want to answer, but is this the best performance by an actor as Peter Parker / Spider-Man, Or are there people out there that have done it better, in your view?
In my view, I think there's people that have done it better.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Can we leave it at that? Otherwise, we'll be here forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought Tobey Maguire was really good in this movie. He carries the movie from start to finish. He reminded me a lot of Elijah Wood in Lord of the Rings. You know, you've got this central character. They have to carry the entire trilogy on their back. And in Lord of the Rings, this young actor does it for 9 hours or so. And, carries the movie. And I thought, I was reminded of that. I was also reminded of the fact that he was up for the role of Frodo Baggins. In Lord of the Rings, that's true. And he didn't get it. But at least he had his opportunity to do something similar in this movie. So we can get on to the scores then. I gave it 9 from memory. You gave it 10, not surprisingly, from memory.
I did, yeah.
So it has a memory score of 19 for those people who are following us, or 9.5 if you prefer the average. So let's score the movie then. Now, at this point, I would normally ask you, do you want to go first or second in your scoring? But I think what we'll do for this season is the person who chose the movie must go first.
Okay.
If you're happy with that. So I chose the movie. I gave it 9 out of 10 from memory. So I'm going to go up to 10 out of 10. I think it's a 10 out of 10 movie. And the reason why I think it's a 10 out of 10 movie, and I think we have to qualify some of the scores that we give. I'll do that in a bit. But it's very good at what it does. What fault could you find in a Spider-Man sequel from 2004 from that movie? Full of really good performances, lovely character moments, great action sequences, really good villain. So 10 out of 10 movie. I want to qualify that by saying just because you give that 10 out of 10 doesn't mean it's the best movie of all time ever. I'm scoring that movie entirely objectively on my experience of rewatching it. So it's a 10. Sam?
I will say one thing that can ruin it is the fact that when Doc Ock's wife is about to die, she doesn't lift her arms to cover the glass from her face. Anyway, my score has changed.
No.
I originally gave it a 10 out of 10. What I want to say before I give the score is that I think this is a fantastic film. It's got a great plot. It's very unique and interesting. All points that I've kind of already made. The film for me never gets old. It's my go-to film when I kind of need uplifting in a way, mm-hmm. or just when I want to watch a film, because it's got that sort of tone to it where you can relate. Obviously, I've got loads of memories of jumping around dressed as Spider-Man, and it does have one of the best tie-in video games.
It does.
Thought I'd throw that in there.
It does.
So my score has changed. I'm going to give it an 11 out of 10. Is that allowed? If that's not allowed and you're a purist, it's a 10 out of 10. But for me, it's an 11.
I'm going to let you give an 11 out of 10.
Thanks.
we'll give you this one because I do know, you know, part of the reason why we do this podcast is not just because we like to talk about movies, but we'll also revisit the experience of watching movies as a father and son. And we get to do that much later, which is lovely, and lots of people have told us that they think it's lovely as well, so thanks to those people. But I'm going to allow it because I know you're welcome. I'm still the dad. I understand completely the significant influence this film and Spider-Man more generally had on your childhood. It was your thing, and I suspect it still is.
Absolutely.
Everybody has a lifelong thing. I've got mine, and I suspect Spider-Man will always be one of yours. So you can give it 11 out of 10 because it is probably the best Spider-Man movie. There we go. All right, so we have the unusual outcome of a movie scoring 21 out of 20 or 10.5 out of 10. But
nice.
There you go. Last thing then, your one-word review of Spider-Man 2.
I thought about this a lot. It's going to be perfect.
Okay, I'm going to go with classic.
Nice.
Because I think it is of its type. So I guess it's time to choose our movie, our next movie. I'm very excited by this because it's been a while since we've had the tension of choosing a movie. So, and it is definitely your turn because I chose Spider-Man 2. So which movie will we be going away and watching this week, Sam?
I changed this quite last minute from what I originally had decided.
Okay.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, so, me too.
Thanks.
Because I didn't know what the original one was, so it's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. we're staying in 2004, and it's the Brad Silberling directed film, A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Wow. Okay. The Lemony Snicket books.
Yep.
Book. I know there was loads of them.
I know, but this one's only based on the first one, isn't it?
That's true. I think, I don't know whether it's the first one or a couple, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I was right in saying that, so we'll see when we watch it.
Let's see. Is this the one with Jim Carrey in it?
It is, yes.
Okay. All right. So you chose the movie. Our new rule says you have to go with your memory score and reflections first.
Okay. So I don't know if I remember much of this film when we originally saw it. I think this is one of the ones that my sister would have been more interested in.
Yeah.
So I think this is probably one of those films that I was tagging along with. It wasn't one that we both went, let's go see this together. I was just sort of there for it, and it was one of those films that we probably would have seen anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have seen it since the cinema, but not in a very recent memory. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go slightly above average, because I think Jim Carrey's a great actor. So I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10.
Okay. I wanted to see the movie because I'd read the books.
Right, and that might have been it.
And I really like the books. The books are very clever, very funny, very witty, and really very well written. And kind of in the vein of the Spiderwick Chronicles, same size, right, same kind of illustrations. And I think the Spiderwick Chronicles is slightly after this as well. So I think it's just one of those things where this is that moment where you know there's going to be lots of other books that have been influenced by it afterwards. And I really enjoyed the books. Thought they were really well written. And so I wanted to see the movie. I do remember being slightly disappointed in it. Didn't quite capture the kind of joy of the books and the intelligence of the books. So I'm going to give it a 4 out of 10. But a little bit like you, it's 2004 when this movie came out. Timestamp the episode by saying it's 2024, so it's 20 years later. I probably haven't watched it in that time. So yeah. I'm going to give it a 4 and hope that that's changed, because, yeah, that's a good one to get into.
I think it is an interesting one to go to, yeah.
And thanks very much for listening, as always. I hope you've enjoyed our return to season 2. Next week is the Series of Unfortunate Events, Lemony Snicket book, as a movie. I'm very much looking forward to going away and watching it. You know, we always do that thing where we say what day it is. Can I do one today? And can I just, and it's kind of one I want to do. It'll come out.
I've got two, but okay.
Okay.
You can do it.
You do your two first.
Apparently it's World Mental Health Day and also World Porridge Day.
World Porridge Day.
Yeah.
I love that.
According to the Wallace and Gromit Instagram account anyway.
I love that it's World Porridge Day today. I have had porridge today.
Whoa.
And this ties in lovely to the thing that I wanted to mention about what today is as well, because this person loved porridge. It's my dad's birthday today, and therefore your granddad's birthday today. So happy birthday, Daddy.
Happy birthday, Granddad.
Wherever you are. All right. Excellent. So thanks very much for listening. Don't forget, you can contact us via all of our social media platforms, and predominantly email is where we get most of our communication. So the Benefit of Hindsight podcast at gmail.com. We'll be back next week with the Series of Unfortunate Events, which I think I've already said. So thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye then.
Bye. Pizza time.
It's what time?
Pizza time.
I thought it said Chico time.
Oh, that too.
Okay, well, pizza, Chico, whatever it is, enjoy.
I think that was pretty good. Of hindsight, we'll see, were the movies truly awful, or did they change history?